front that we did hold for members of the World Federation of Mental Health, but if some people want to come and just fill them in, there's one over here. Sit on each other's laps. Dr. Mead just remarked to me that it was a good thing it snowed. Welcome to the opening lecture of what we fully anticipate and now know to be a truly exciting spring series of the Vancouver Institute. First of all, 1975 was proclaimed at the UN to be International Women's Year, and we in Vancouver can anticipate a great many exciting events taking place on and off the campus throughout this year. Last Sunday, the Vancouver Symphony launched its year season with three women soloists, a singer, a flautist, and a harpist. And tonight, we at the Institute are fortunate enough to have Dr. Margaret Mead as our speaker through her long association with the World Federation of Mental Health. I may say at this point that we fully anticipated this overflow crowd and did our very best to give television, closed circuit television, to the other rooms, and I hope you can all see and hear as best as possible. It gives me great pleasure to introduce to you Professor Tsung-Yi Lin of the UBC's Department of Psychiatry, who has been newly elected president of the World Federation for Mental Health, which provided the raison d'etre for opening the headquarters for the Federation in Vancouver. It is actually in celebration of this event that the Institute was fortunate enough to provide the forum for Dr. Mead's appearance. May I present Dr. Tsung-Yi Lin, who will introduce our guest speaker.
Thank you, Mrs. Armstrong, ladies and gentlemen. First, I should like to thank the Vancouver Institute for joining with us for this very important lecture. It is a singular honor and pleasure to perform my first public function as a president of the World Federation for Mental Health by introducing Dr. Margaret Mead. This pleasure is doubled by the simplicity of the task, as Dr. Mead needs no introduction. Before I present her, I'd like to call your attention to the special significance of her presence in Vancouver tonight. She was one of the founding members in 1948 of the World Federation for Mental Health, along with such distinguished people as Harry Stack Sullivan of the USA, Jack Rees of UK, and none other than our beloved Brock Zism of Canada. Dr. Mead herself served as chairman of the executive board and also president of the World Federation for Mental Health. It is therefore particularly appropriate that she should be here with us as we are busy establishing our world headquarters in Vancouver to start us on the four-year Canadian chapter in the history of the World Federation for Mental Health. We move our offices to the country of the president every 4 years. The general purpose of the Federation is to make the science and practice of mental health improve the care of the sick and promote better relationship between people and between groups of nations. This was the vision of the founding members in 1948, and 20 years later here in Vancouver, it is still our hope. We are most grateful to the Vancouver Institute for cooperating with us on this occasion, and we hope very much that the Vancouverites will support us in our activities. Bring a series of eminent speakers here during the next few years, beginning tonight with Dr. Margaret Mead, one of the world's foremost leaders in anthropology, behavior science, and mental health. Here, at this important point in our growth, is Margaret Mead.
Thank you. side. Is this all right? Madam Chairperson. Dr. Chairperson. In a sense, coming here today for this new chapter in the World Federation for Mental Health, I feel that it's a little like when I first came in. In 1948, the world was just ending a major war. We barely spoke to each other in many parts of the world, and we had very little idea how the tremendous disorganization that followed the war was going to be worked out. I remember we had the conference in London when there were still rationing, food rationing in England. And the newspapers that were not nearly as sophisticated as they are today. I believe they sent a police court reporter to report our sessions. And the main note was that the people who called them World Congress for Mental Health ought to have their heads examined for having a conference where no one had enough to eat in London. And there was still food rationing in London, and we were subjected to considerable wartime restrictions. Now, at that inauguration, one of the points that we worked on hardest was the way in which the mental health of populations was related to war and peace, to social justice, to the relationships of races to each other. And one of the things was, could you have true mental health in a society that was unjust? And of course, it was right after the war, and we were majorly discussing Nazi Germany. And we settled the problem by saying that mental health was incompatible with any society like the Nazis. That they hadn't been a society at all because they hadn't lasted a generation. And that the test of a true society was that it did last through generations and worked out a relationship among all its members, which made it possible to accept all its members as full human beings. We came out with a statement called Mental Health and World Citizenship. And as you know, the word world is very suspect. It's almost as suspect as international. And so periodically there have been various worries about the World Federation promoting world government, because how could you have world citizenship without world government? Which is one of the things we're going to have to find out, is how you can have world citizenship without world government. And it's going to be necessary to find it out. But most of the things that we talked about then as necessary haven't happened yet. And yet the climate in the world has developed enormously since 1948. It's done it imperceptibly, and some of us, I think, don't realize it. But in 1948, we could argue about the obligation of this country, this continent, to help feed Europe and to help feed Japan. That is, to help feed the countries that we had defeated in war. But to have suggested in 1948 that we were responsible for the whole world was still a long way off. And it was a very long way off, actually, also, for the burst of freeing colonies that spread around the world, and for our beginning acceptance of the autonomous existence of all the different peoples in the world. We have come a very long way, but we're also a very long way from settling the problems that worried us then, from preventing war, although we have prevented a Third World War. And I think of the United Nations today should remember that we have not had a world war. If we had, of course, we would not be here. But we're still very far from the kind of world that we want, and we're in a new period of extreme disorganization, as we were at the end of World War II. there are going to be a profound changes in the next decade again, and the things that we were worried about then are going to be relevant again now. So I'm delighted that the headquarters of the World Federation is going to be here. I'm delighted that it's going to be here where also Habitat is going to meet in 76, and we're going to deal with the whole problem of human settlements on this planet. I hope to be coming back to Vancouver for Habitat as well as for the periodic councils of the World Federation with Dr. Lin. Now, what I want to talk about tonight is the importance to us all of the beliefs we have, the theories we have about human aggression, and using aggression in the popular sense, as the popular sense of the word makes aggression a bad thing. You can talk about good aggression and people don't believe you very well. It's rather hard to do. It's like good anxiety, and which is true but not believable. And so that when most people use the word aggression, they mean aggression in the sense of war, and we're always arguing about who started the war, and of course no one ever did. And so I'm using it in that sense. That is, what are definitions based on science or philosophy or ideology are of why human beings fight each other, go to war with each other, destroy each other's property and each other's persons? Now, there's a great deal of talk in the world about the way in which our theories relate to the times in which we live and are shaped by the times in which we live. But it's very important also to realize the extent to which its enemies, and if it met any, it would kill them. It's not able to classify them or think about them. And the distinctive thing about man is that we learn to think about people at a distance. People and people that were born 1,000 years ago. And people, there are some parts of the world where we're still conducting wars on the basis of what somebody said about somebody else, some other group of people, hundreds of years ago. And of course, Ireland at present is somewhat of a testimony to our people's memory of the past and continuing memory of the past, and so are the troubles in the Middle East. So that human beings can think about people they've never seen, they can think about people they've never seen with affection. We think of the fellow members of our nation. We're willing to go to war to protect them. And we've never met them. And if we had, we likely wouldn't like them particularly. But nevertheless, they're members of the same nation. And in the same way, we're able to transform millions of people overnight from friends to enemies. Or if not from friends, from people whom it would be murder to kill. And this is a particular human trait. But it's not a trait about killing, it's a trait about a capacity to dehumanize other human beings by a stroke of symbolism. And any of you have read Solzhenitsyn's 1914? There is a magnificent statement that is almost like the good behavior of animals that's always being pointed out to us. In World War I, a piece of the German army and a piece of the Russian army got lost, and they met each other on a hill, just a few of them. Two generals and just a few of each, and they looked at each other and they were both generals, and they were both officers, and they bowed, and they didn't fight. They bowed, they were a little awkward, they maneuvered a little, and they bowed, and they went. One went down the hill one way, and one went down the hill the other, exactly like the stags. But most of the time, we're not caught in this kind of situation. So that I think one of the first things that it's important to realize when we have these comparisons of ourselves with animals, and with the statement that we behave so much worse, is that our worst behavior, if you like, is a function of our higher mental development and our capacity for symbolism. Well, the next theoretical point that's been made a great deal and that some people have taken very seriously is Konrad Lorenz's insistence that aggression is part of the nature of every living creature and that it is strongest when the creature, bird or beast or human being, is defending the thing that they care about. So that the animals defend their nests and they defend their young. Very weak animals are extraordinarily brave in attempting to defend their young against a stronger predator. And that the point that Lorenz makes is that man can be most easily roused to warlike behavior by playing upon his best instincts. And that is his instinctive willingness to defend and protect the thing that he loves. We can even carry that a little further, as this is Women's International Year, and point out that females don't fight except in defense of their nests. And that it is doubtful if they would ever have a Christmas truce if they were fighting. And that there are certain elements in the fighting behavior of males that are almost play behavior with rules. And this may possibly be the reason that no society has ever given women weapons for any length of time. Not because they're too peaceful, but because they'd be too fierce as young mothers. And that although we can have a certain amount of dependence upon the peaceful and cherishing capacities of postmenopausal grandmothers, who are probably the most conserving group in a society, it's somewhat balanced by the ferociousness of young mothers who have to care for their babies and who would certainly care for them up to the hilt. So that Lorenz has not said that we are endlessly warlike, that we are creatures that love to destroy other creatures, that destructiveness is an important part of human behavior. He simply said that the impulse or the instinctive protection of the thing one values is an intrinsic part of human behavior and can be played upon, and can, of course, be played upon by demagogues, who will appeal, the minute they appeal to the population of a country that you are defending your country, you're defending your religion, you're defending your language, you're defending your ancestors and your children and your children's children. This is the point when people's capacity and willingness to fight is most mobilized. Now, I don't want to discuss in as much detail, but I think we should mention just briefly the theory that emphasizes very heavily the differences between human beings, with the possibility that there are some human beings who are at least much more assertive, much more muscularly active, and maybe more destructive, simply because they are so strong and they don't know what to do with their strength. It's a certain kind of pathological child that we find that is terribly destructive, and it may be merely that they are stronger than other people. They may have an extra chromosome. We've now heard about those women they don't like in the Olympics that have the extra chromosomes. I don't know whether they've been keeping any men with extra chromosomes out of the Olympics or not. I think they're all women. It's unwomanly. But the possibility that there are individuals who either genetically or because of early childhood experience do become killers. And this is at present a fairly important issue in large countries where we do have now a fair number of pathological killers. The sort of murderer, killer of the student in Texas who got up on a tower and just shot a lot of people from the tower. We're having more and more incidents of this sort. And there is a possibility that these individuals are in some way so distorted that they will kill and kill strangers. And one of the edge issues that's very important in the understanding of psychiatry and the understanding of mental health is whether the general public feels that the psychiatrist is protecting those people and overprotecting them and letting them loose again in society. And there have been some recent suits against mental hospitals who've released people who have subsequently become murderers. And this is a separate problem, but a problem that is acute, especially acute for psychiatry and for law as we're making it today. Then there is, of course, the social theory that believes if we had a perfect society, and the people who believe this think they have the formula for a perfect society, if we had a perfect society, there would be no violence, no one would ever take anything from anyone else, there would be no theft, and no arson, and no rape, and no murder, and people would live in complete brotherly love because the society had been properly designed. That is a utopian picture, but it's a picture that can be argued politically with considerable vehemence, so that when one looks at our own society and the number of people that are brought up, who are brought distorted by their upbringing, we can have the people who claim that this is all due to whatever system they don't like. Of course, in our society, it's due to capitalism, and in other societies, they will claim it's due to communism. But that the social system is responsible for anything that goes wrong. Now, there's a considerable argument in favor of the importance of the social system in the degree of destructiveness that people will manifest. Canada has about 1/10 the homicide rate that the United States has. And yet it's rather hard to argue that at the border all methods of bringing up children change abruptly, and that in Canada no child is frustrated, while in the United States they're frustrated 10 times as much and spend their time shooting each other. A more likely explanation is the number of guns in the United States. And somebody pointed out to me today, it's one piece of very valuable information I got today, is that not only does the United States have 10 times the number of homicides that Canada does, but it takes out 10 times as much life insurance. Now, if that's true, it's extraordinarily interesting. It's one of the most interesting correlates that I've seen for a long time. But Japan has hardly any homicides at all. And if you look at the list of countries and the homicide rate, the only thing that it correlates with that we can find is the number of guns, whether or not the government cares whether people have guns or not. And in those countries where the government thinks that it prefers its citizens not to have guns, which tend to be governments that think the citizens would use the guns against the government, we don't have a lot of guns. In the United States, the government is not at least worried that the people will use guns against the establishment. We may use it against individual officers or presidents, but not against the establishment. The general system in the United States is to let people fight it out, and the government takes the side of the winner. And And furthermore, in the United States, a gun is there to protect the good little man, because big bad men have guns. And the only way the good little man can equal the big bad man is with a gun. And so the American Rifle Society has a motto that says, God created man and Dr. Colt made them equal. And so if you look at just comparative figures on violence, we haven't any reason to believe that the Japanese children may not be as frustrated as American children, but the police in Tokyo don't let people have guns, and as there are no guns around to kill people, whatever feelings they may have, they seem to take out in different ways. So, and wherever we look at comparative national statistics of this sort, or at the same country over time, it's very clear that the social arrangements make a tremendous difference in the amount of destructiveness and violence that you find between people. And some nations are very warlike at one period and become exceedingly peaceful at another, and their genes are presumably the same, but their changes occur within inside the nation. England, in the early part of the 19th century, was one of the most violent, disorderly countries in Europe. And you couldn't go out at night. It was like New York. People had private guards, and it was very dangerous to go anywhere, and there's a tremendous amount of public crime. And then Sir Robert Peel, as all good historians of English life know, invented the bobby. The peelers, as they were first called, and then they were called bobbies. He got the idea that if you got big, patient, quiet, oversized men who had never had to fight anybody in their lives, and put them in uniform and put them in charge, everything would be fine. And he didn't arm them. And so they got big, oversized men, tinkers, tailors, soldiers, sailors. We have the list of the occupations they came from. And the only requirement was they must be big and patient. And in a reasonably short time, London, from being the most unruly city in Europe, became the most ruly city in Europe. It's just beginning to lose that character today, to some extent, but it hasn't lost it completely. But it isn't as peaceful as it once was. And even we can even go further, and we can look at the same city under different conditions. We had an instance in New York where we had a peace march on the United Nations, and the police did very well. They were well disciplined, they planned, they saw to it that exits were always open so that no one was ever pushed against the wall. If any anti-peace people came along, they hustled them off the scene quietly, and we had a demonstration of 20,000 people with no trouble at all. And 3 weeks later, they had a demonstration they hadn't prepared for that appeared in the worst place, and they had a lot of trouble. And the same police behaved well on Tuesday, you know, and three Tuesdays worse later, they behaved terribly. So that we know that situations are also responsible for the same people being able to behave in a destructive and violent way or in a responsible and peacekeeping fashion. So that we have a good deal of material that suggests that the major determinants of whether people will be destructive and violent towards their neighbors or will engage in a large amount of aggressive warfare is a function of the way the social system is organized and the way it plays upon human emotion. And if people believe that human beings are naturally aggressive, naturally warlike, naturally predatory, that having once hunted meat, we will always be the kind of people who want to hunt something, If they believe that, of course, they will make no genuine effort at any organizational form that might prevent war. They will not be concerned in organizing society in ways that will protect children. They will not be concerned in organizing society in ways that will minimize conflict between racial groups or religious groups, because they will accept this as of the nature of man. Therefore, it is exceedingly important what people believe, how they handle the evidence about aggressiveness and destructiveness and violence, because it may make all the difference in what we believe is possible and how we believe that the relationships that are set up in a given society at a given time affect the propensity of members of that society to engage in either internal or external conflict and war. Now, one of the points that has been made most repetitively about human beings' tendency towards war is based on territoriality. And they study animals, all sorts, fish one minute, birds the next, some mammal the next, and point out the extent to which creatures will defend their fishing territory or their nests or their hunting territory, and then leap with very little warning into Israel or Northern Ireland and say, you see, and we're getting the same kind of creatures today, same kind of creatures behavior among us. And there's a fairly cogent case to be made, not that we have an instinct for territoriality, because you don't need to postulate an instinct of territoriality. All you need to point out is that two people can't stand in the same place at the same time, that two people can't build a house on the same piece of ground, two different houses, that two people can't make gardens in the same spot, and that, in fact, we live on the ground, with our feet on the ground, and the ground is limited. And if a population begins to expand and they need ground, you then move towards conditions that may lead to conflict, may lead to one group pushing out another in an attempt to get its land, and the group whose land is threatened fighting. You don't have to have any instinct, particularly, except a general willingness to defend the thing that is valued. But as this is so, many people have felt that warfare was almost inevitable, that as the world became more crowded, the competition for land would become greater, that we have used up almost all the arable land in the world now. There's very little really good cultivatable land left. In a place like Bangladesh, they virtually make land. A little bit of land is silted up and from some kind of flood, and they go out and cherish it. And if they plant sisal to export, they have less food, so that you have a competition not only between groups, but within a society for the use of land. And that these conditions, which are partly the conditions that are now producing famine in the world, are such that conflict is almost inevitable, and that the crowding that occurs in countries like India is a sort of crowding that condemns millions of people, possibly to death. And a belief that this is inevitable and there's no way in which we can deal with it leads to the sorts of statements about ethics, I don't think I should call them ethical, but statements about ethics, which propose that we should let a third of the world starve, which are being made by people now. And there was an article in the New York Times last Sunday with such a proposition, discussing what was called triage in World War I, where they used to, with limited supplies, limited doctors, limited nurses, sort the wounded between those who could be saved and those who couldn't. and people who want to apply this to the world and say that there are parts of the world where the competition for land and for food is too great, there's nothing to be done with them, cut them off, and utterly neglect the fact that if we did, we would be unable to build a decent society after we'd done it. But this, the competition for land and the overcrowding in the world and the history, if we go back into very primitive people, into New Guinea or into Africa, you find endless conflicts between people who want to graze their herds compared to the people who want to plant their crops and so forth. So that it was a pretty pessimistic doctrine when people began talking about territoriality, even though one might not believe it was an instinct, but it seemed a byproduct of the condition that land on this planet was limited, the population was increasing, and that there was more or less inevitable competition. Now, something has happened in the world that no one predicted. I don't think anyone predicted it any more than anyone predicted the recent oil crisis. I think it's astonishing that nobody predicted the recent oil crisis. But they didn't. The fact that overnight the oil-producing countries would just say, this is it, was something that no one thought of as a possibility, although we knew that they'd gradually take a little more, we thought, and we knew that we were going to run out of oil sooner or later. Well, I don't think anyone 100 years ago or 50 years ago could have predicted that this state of the world today is a state in which the greatest danger is not competition of land or running out of land, or the battles that will be fought over the protection of frontiers that will provoke wars. But the greatest danger is in the air. That it's the atmosphere that is in danger. And that our future is not determined by squabbles over land, but our future is determined over the fact that we may poison the air so that nobody on this planet can live. And that if we continue to pour toxic substances into the air, all the way from plutonium to the results of smog, we may so damage the atmosphere within the next 20 or 30 years that life will be uninhabitable on this planet. Now, the planet will be uninhabitable, rather, by life, any form of life. Now, the fascinating thing about air is that frontiers don't make any difference, that barriers of no sort make any difference, that there is no such thing as one's air territory. Now, of course, we attempt to imitate the old style, and the Soviet Union announced they owned the air up to infinity, and with characteristic expansiveness. And that gives them the justification for shooting down a spy plane and arguing that out in international circles. But there is no way in which Toronto's can keep the smog of the United States, in which Vancouver can keep Seattle smog out, or Seattle can keep Vancouver smog out. No known frontiers, no Maginot line, no line of any sort. The atmosphere of the Earth belongs to all of us, and the poison that goes in at any spot goes round the world and comes back again. Now, this has produced quite a new situation, because where human beings in the past have fought for land and for food and for natural resources occasionally, for gold and things of that sort, all of which were limited and in the earth and therefore created conditions of conflict and create conditions that was hard to plan for and hard to get people to cooperate about, we now have a situation where cooperation is absolutely necessary. And furthermore, where there is no conflict between the types of emotion that we have thought of as conflicting over the last 50 years. Because one of the great arguments of the last 50 years has been between the internationalists, who felt that what nationalism was the greatest danger, and the patriots, who felt that internationalism was the greatest danger. And the whole of North America, of course, has been divided over this issue. And one side said the other side had no patriotism, they didn't love their country, they didn't love their language, they didn't love everything that belonged to their past. And the other side said that unless the whole world combines to protect the whole world, we will destroy each other. And the fact that we now share air in the atmosphere in the way we do puts those two things together. If the people of Los Angeles don't care enough about their own children so that they let a smog grow that means their own children can't go out to play, they're also pouring that into the air and it will come back again and produce worse smog and as well as endangering all their neighbors. So that we are now faced as a human community with something that we can only save if we share it, instead of being faced with limitations on ground, on grazing land, on agricultural land, and on mineral and non-replaceable resources. And this gives us an opportunity to develop societies that are cooperative that we've never had before. It's also an opportunity that may not continue, because unless we learn how to handle the things that we're doing to the atmosphere, we won't be here. And so that we will probably put a tremendous amount of technological effort into solving some of those problems. Once we solve them, we won't have the opportunity to cooperate that we have now. So that this is probably an opportunity that may last 25 years or 50 years only in the history of the human race, but it's a unique opportunity. It's a situation, and the teacher knows about human potentiality to the structure of the world that we live in, to the way our cities are built. That's where habitat's going to come in, because the way in which our cities are built are one of the crucial things in the way we relate to each other today. So just as in 1948, when we held the first World Congress, stressing that we must work together as the whole world, that we must have representatives of every continent in the World Federation, we must have men and women and young people and old people and members of every discipline working together if we were going to work towards this kind of a world, if we were going to use our knowledge of human behavior in ways that would be constructive for the whole of humanity. We are in the same spot again today with the possibility that the state of disturbance in the world may be the kind of state in which people may be able to take a forward step. Do you need this then? Well, I'll take it from one to one or something.
In the tradition of the Vancouver Institute, this is known as the question period. And of course, we can't handle questions, regrettably, from the other two rooms, but we'll do the best we can from questioners in this room. I have to ask you to speak up because we can't pass the microphone around. I'll repeat the question. Are there any questions that Dr. Mead can answer for you?
Yes.
The lady asked whether she could have her book autographed.
Dr. Mead, yes. Would you like to comment on the use of aggression in primitive
Dr. Mead has been asked whether she would comment on aggression in primitive societies.
It isn't any different from ours, you know. I mean, you have primitive societies that are very peaceful. The Eskimo didn't have war, and you can see why not, you know, 400 square miles per person or something. You didn't really need it. However, the Eskimo did occasionally kill each other. A man killed another man occasionally to get his wife, and he then adopted the children, who then grew up to avenge their father, which is a peculiar form of sense of justice developed in a primitive society. If you imagine what it was like to bring up some stepchildren, that one of whom was going to kill you later. I know many people feel like that now, but there are, on the other hand, there are pygmies on the Andaman Islands, who were tiny little creatures, and there weren't very many of them, but they'd heard about war, and they used to send armies of 15 into the field, 15 on one side and 14 on the other, and they declared war and they made peace. So that once you've invented warfare as a social form, it can be practiced in the most unlikely circumstances. So that the only difference between primitive societies and our own is the as far as this subject is concerned, is the tremendous numbers that are involved. And that we now have invented a way of turning 20 million people at the drop of a hat into people who are no longer must be protected against murder, but whom it's glorious to murder. Whereas the primitive people would only turn 20, or 40, or 400. But we have also invented a way in which we can turn 200 million people into fellow citizens who have to be protected and cared for in some way, and whom it is murder to kill. See, we know of no society in the world that does not make a distinction between murder and war. Whenever war comes in, then warfare means it is not murder, as long as you're following the proper conditions of war. But we've steadily expanded the number whom we can't murder and the number whom we can. This is the present state of civilization. But otherwise, there aren't any differences that are significant. We can find examples in primitive society of every sort of attitude towards violence and towards war that we find in our own.
Yes.
You mentioned war being invented. Do historians that you know of have any idea when war actually was invented?
Dr. Mead was asked, she spoke of the invention of war, and she's asked now if any historians have commented on when war was invented, in quotes.
No, we don't know. I mean, we find it, as I say, among some very, very primitive people, and among some very isolated people, and therefore we have to assume it was invented a very long time ago. The real idea of war, that is, not that you simply fought accidentally with some other people that you met, whom you hadn't expected to meet, and were frightened of, which may have occurred for a very long time. We may have had a million years when the earth was very slightly populated, but little groups of people didn't know there was anybody else but themselves that were human. And if they met some other human beings that looked a little different, they might have run away or fought them just because they were frightened. But without the invention of war. And we don't call it war unless there is peace, in a sense. That is, you have to have the idea that there's a changed state of relationships, and that those people that you were trading with and marrying yesterday are now enemies, and have to be treated in a different way, and then this may go on for years and years, and then you have a peace ceremony. And then there isn't war for a while, and then you start it again. But it's probably very, very old, and we don't know how old. But, of course, the extensive war of conquest It was undertaken for purposes of conquest. You couldn't have large-scale war until you had large-scale food supplies that made it possible for a lot of men to spend their time going to war. And you couldn't have a lot of men spending their time going to war until you had food you could store. And so that they were, it freed them, as agriculture freed people for all sorts of other activities of civilization.
Yes.
Judge, you mentioned the need for world citizenship in your example of the Arab Literature Center, obviously makes it very apparent. Do you see any mechanisms besides foreign world citizenship, besides the change in human sentiment that would happen after a major crisis?
Dr. Mead mentioned world citizenship and has now asked whether it is possible under any other method other than a Holocaust.
Under any other method but world government? Was that what you meant?
I'm asking, obviously, after some major crisis, human sentiment might change. Is there any way to see the advent of world citizenship?
No, I don't think it's a question of sentiment, you see, changing entirely. I think that citizenship in the past has been related to borders. That what made you a citizen of one nation were the frontiers around that nation, you know, and the frontier between the United States and Canada. We couldn't possibly defend it. I don't know what in the world we'd do with it, but there it is, and it makes the difference. You go over one side, you're in Canada, and a train goes around there, and you can't do what you can on the other side, all the rest of it. We've drawn lines on the ground, and we've said, this is one country, and that's another, and we're citizens. And it's the border that made the difference. Now we're moving towards a position where the borders don't matter. It's the country itself that matters. In other words, one's orientation in towards the protection of the whole is greater because you can't protect the frontier anymore when we're protecting the air. So that what we're going to need is a relation to wholes, to one's family, one's community, one's region, one's nation, one's continent, and the world, which will not be a question of relating to a group that's over against another group. Now, as long as you have a small group that's set over against another group, you have a great deal of difficulty managing any kind of world unity. Now, I don't think that it will ever manage a world government. If we had found a really lively and nasty civilization on Mars, we might have been able to handle a world government. But we'd only have handled it because there was an external enemy. And lots of people in the 50s hoped there was, you know. And we thought that would fix us, you know. And they'd come over us and float around in airships and say, quit, you know. And we'd quit. We probably would. But we've discovered there isn't any such life anywhere in the solar system. There's nobody but us. Therefore, the mechanism of world government vis-a-vis another world won't work. And if we had a world government, I think we'd spend our entire time rebelling against it. It's the first thing we'd think of. Because it's modeled on a nation state. And a nation state is modeled on the existence of other nation states that are rivals and competitors. So I think we're going to have to develop some way in which we can relate to the planet through relating to smaller groups and overlapping groups that will not depend on a central power that puts a line around us vis-a-vis someone else.
Dr. Mead, I wonder if you could comment on the relationship between aggression between countries and their declining economic situation in the world. Okay. Is this going to increase or not?
Dr. Mead's asked to comment on human aggression vis-a-vis the declining economic situation in the world.
Well, the point that there's a declining economic situation in the world is who you're talking about. I don't think that Iran thinks there's a declining economic situation in the world. What you're talking about is a temporary redistribution. And now, how people will respond to scarcity varies very much by countries. Some countries behave much better under austerity and scarcity than they do under affluence. And I think we've demonstrated fairly completely in the last 25 years that affluence is not good for Americans. In fact, it's very bad for them, and I have a suspicion it may not be too good for Canadians. And so that an austerity situation, if it doesn't reach too great proportions, brings people together. And the behavior of, especially of North America, in the Great Depression, was an example of it. We didn't have endless revolutions and riots and whatnot. You know, a few people took the town hall in Seattle for 3 days or something. That was about it, when you consider that what you say will happen under extreme economic conditions. Under extreme economic conditions, we pulled ourselves together and developed a better social system than we had before. Whereas under very affluent economic conditions, we started to take it to pieces again in the United States, till we would have been back before Roosevelt if we'd kept on very much longer. England certainly, under the extreme conditions of World War II, never showed higher morale, greater generosity than they showed then. But there's some countries who probably, maybe there are countries who behave well when they're rich, and there's some countries who behave very badly when they're poor. So that you have to consider it in terms of particular countries and how they're going to behave, and who's in power at the particular moment. The people who behave worse under a depression are the people that have to give up half their comforts. The people in the United States that had to give up one of their two cars never got over it. Whereas the people who had to go, who lost everything, who had to go home and live with father, who sold apples on the street, recovered. And I think that's well worth thinking about.
Yes, I'll take that question.
Yes, I'd like to ask Dr. Lee how she thinks last year's explosion of India's nuclear bomb relates to her social situation.
And Dr. Mead has asked how she would relate India's explosion of the nuclear bomb to the social situation.
I would relate it as the worst sign that I know of the total irrationality of the countries that have bombs that I have ever encountered anywhere. The talk you hear about India, well, they should starve. They made a bomb. We have made enough bombs to destroy the entire world 7 times. India made one little miserable bomb. And it helped their sense of dignity. It gave Mrs. Gandhi a chance, possibly, to rule the country. And I have never heard such virtuous remarks in my life. All over the United States. Why should we feed India? Well, why should we feed ourselves?
You had your comment. Yes, back there.
Is there a relationship between the play forms of the society and its state of aggression?
Is there a relationship between play forms in society and their aggression?
Well, we've always hoped there was. And we've always stated it both ways. You know, World War I was won on the playing fields of England. As anybody who's old enough to remember knows, we said. We've also said that the beautiful tendency of people with an Anglo-Saxon background to spend most of their lives on sport at the expense of every other activity was one of the ways that made them such good people, and developed a sense of justice and fair play and camaraderie and whatnot. And people talked about meetings of the International Labor Organization in Geneva. They never could understand the English, because after the most heated discussions, they'd shake hands. Now, there are undoubtedly some relationships between the presence of different kinds of games, the way those games are looked at, that can be seen between two countries with games. That is, if a country is more interested in winning than in playing the game, then the contrast between them is very great. And we felt that Eastern Europe's concentration on winning was unsportsmanlike. And, you know, they give their teams everything in the world, so they become substantially professionals, and we want to keep our amateur standing and things of this sort. Now, the one interesting point, though, that I think we think we're talking about when we talk about games is the question of whether we let young boys particularly learn to tussle with each other and get over it. That there is, it seems from the evidence that we have at present, that boys need to test whether they're brave, whether they can take it, whether they can dish it out. They need to test their capacity to face danger, to use skill, to climb trees, to swim, and to wrestle with other boys of their own age and size. And that letting them do this under controlled conditions, that is, teaching them you don't pick on somebody half your size, you know, and you don't hit below the belt, and you don't carry the fight too far, and you shake hands afterwards and are friends, may be important. Because when we compare the kind of massacres that occur in India and that occurred in Indonesia with people who do not permit children to fight, it does look as if learning to control fighting in childhood and in boyhood, learning to measure it out and have some rules, was a good thing. See, I've studied Bali in great detail. I never saw two children engaged in a single struggle in the whole time I was in Bali. We received one account from one informant that when he was a little boy, and he was so young that he still had a sort of scalp lock that the little boys wear flowers in, he had gotten into a fight with his cousin. And his father had taken the two little boys and tied their hair together and made them sit side by side for 12 hours to teach them that fighting is too intimate. And there was no struggle ever permitted. The minute two children started to tussle, 18 months would pull on the same object, they were immediately taken apart. Now the Balinese, when they got started in any kind of violence, had no idea how to stop. When they caught a thief, they would beat a gong and everybody in the village came out and beat the thief to death. And 200,000 people were murdered in Bali at the time of the attempted political coup. People who were totally peaceful, people whose idea, who explained the fact that there had once been wars in Bali, and there was a moat around the village where we lived, and we said, what was that? And they said, oh, that was for the time of the wars. And we said, well, how did it fit into a war? Well, you know, if you were angry at somebody and went to his house and found a fence around it, you'd go home. And that was their picture. And there was no experience, experience in controlling physical aggression of any sort. And India, that has stood so blatantly for peacefulness, has also been a country in which there have been an extraordinary amount of communal violence. And when the riots start, there's no way of stopping them. They've had no experience. And it's virtually impossible to imagine the same kind of riots occurring in England as have occurred in the East. And yet little boys in England, you know, the general position is you're born bad and we'll help you to be good. And you've got awful instincts, but we'll work on it, and Nanny will be here, and don't butter in the stomach or she'll get cancer. And as you get older, will teach you how to behave, and when you grow up, you will know how to control your desires to fight or to destroy. Now, I think we express this in talking about games, but you can play the same game to win and be absolutely murderous, or to play it and learn to play according to the rules, and that it's more important to play the game well according to the rules than to win. And we have these very curious things that we don't quite know what to say about. Of something like 35 countries, Spain has the lowest homicide rate. And yet everybody knows how violent Spaniards are. And the bullfight was their principal form of amusement. Now, the bullfight has now been overtaken by football. And nobody knows what the consequences will be.
Yes, sir.
Dr. Mead, could you comment on the relation of population pressure and the possibility of war? I'm thinking, for instance, of the possibility of conflict between China, where we have something like 800 million people, and the virtual demographic vacuum which exists in Siberia.
Dr. Mead is asked to comment on the population pressures vis-a-vis war struggle.
Well, I think, again, things are exceedingly complicated there. That just having a very fast-growing population, but under conditions of great suffering and deprivation, may turn to war if there's a political ideology that is able to blame the suffering on a neighboring people. That if that kind of idea, or on a class, you may have civil war as a result of population pressure. But on the other hand, you may have a population reduced to such a low level of energy and such a struggle just to live that you don't get any energy left for war. And then you have all the other problems, such as, do you believe in reincarnation or not? You see, one of the reasons that we find it so difficult to understand India is that we believe you only have one life. And the important thing is to live as long as possible and keep your teeth. But the Indians believe that you have a myriad lives. And if you don't do too well in this one, well, there are other lives to come again. And if you lead a good life in the religious sense, you can be born into a more favorable state, which they see around them also. And it's not, you know, preparing for heaven. It's preparing to live better on this earth in another life. Well, your willingness to go to war and fight other people so that more of your children can live longer and keep their teeth is very tempered under those conditions. So that certainly the population pressure on this planet has got to be stopped. It's producing more and more misery all the time. And it's also producing more and more pollution. This continent, we're not suffering from population pressure, but a child here produces about 40 times the pollution they do in India. So too many children in India is producing starvation, and the children we have here are producing too much pollution. So that whether you're talking about pollution and consumption of irreplaceable resources, or whether you're talking about food and starvation, we have to do something about population. But I don't think it's a direct cause of war. I think it has all sorts, population pressure will have all sorts of different effects depending upon the way the society is organized.
Yes, the lady. Dr. Mead has asked what long-term effects she would like to see result from International Women's Year.
Well, I think it's important in the light of some of the discussions I've heard today from people who are interested in International Women's Year and who seem to be a little discontented with Canada's contribution to it, which compared with ours is so good that I am not discontented, because it's going to, what will be done will be to spend the money on producing a big world conference. But the instead of it's going to women's groups. Now, I think that all you can ever expect from a United Nations conference or a United Nations year is establishing a climate of opinion. And a climate of opinion is established because there is a conference, because there are big preparations for it, because the press talks about it, because people make movies about it and look at them afterwards, and because statements are built up and enunciated. So that I think we may be expecting something from International Women's Year that is different from what has been appropriate from the United Nations. And we expected all sorts of things from Bucharest and the population conference, which was nonsense. Bucharest wasn't going to stop the growth of population overnight. All Bucharest did was to, for the first time in history, to get all the governments there to agree that human beings had a right to access to the knowledge and means of how to space the number of their children. That was all. But that was tremendous. Now, if International Women's Year calls attention to the fact that there are tremendous dislocations today in the relations between men and women, in what we expect of women and what we permit them to do, in what we expect of men, because they're just as bad in many ways, and gets us thinking about the division of labor again in relation to the modern world, I think it will do as much as we can expect it to do. And one of the things we hope for most is it will call attention to the fact that women have steadily been removed from any decision-making role in regard to food. That in all village level and tribal societies, women control the distribution, the processing and of food and the feeding of children and the old. And as food became more and more political and more business, it passed more and more into the complete control of men. And the further it's gone into the control of men, the more we've thought of food as something we made money with or made politics with that didn't feed people. And this is very, very serious. It's the most serious in FAO, which is a direct descendant of an emphasis on agriculture, where what men did was to produce the harvest, and then women did the rest. And as FAO is totally masculine, virtually, all we have is the harvest. And over 90% of their research has gone into food before it leaves the field. And nothing on nutrition, and processing has gotten into a business that has nothing to do with nourishing people. And as when food becomes international, then the lack of the presence of women at higher political levels becomes very serious. So one of the things that we hope very much for is that the importance of women in food, in handling food, will be reasserted, and we'll realize that if we're going to treat food as food for people and not agribusiness, we're going to have women at all levels of policy making, because that's where food is disposed of today. The recognition of the importance of this element is directly due to the preliminary conferences for International Women's Year, when the women who came from the developing countries started talking about women in the country, rural women, and the fact nothing had been done for them. And that it was very important for them to have other opportunities, or they'd just go on having children, and that they were being barred out of food production as machines took the place of people. And the recognition of this then led to our inspecting what was happening and realizing what was happening in FAO, and this led to the food conference. So this is a byproduct already of the preparations that were held for International Women's Year.
Yes.
Dr. B, there was recently a meeting, I think in London, of anthropologists from all over the world who met there to discuss the plight of several million primitive people whose lifestyles and traditional ways of looking after themselves is terribly different. And I don't think they arrived at any solutions for how these people could be protected. But I wonder if you're, as an anthropologist, if you have any ideas, any alternatives on the reserve system in North America or other things that will protect the ancient lifestyles of these people.
Dr. Mead was asked to comment on the meeting in London recently of anthropologists about their concern for the preservation of primitive peoples and their mores and ways of life.
Well, the anthropologists, of course, are the people who know best about, know best about what civilization does to primitive people. I mean, we've studied it most extensively, and we've worked very hard first to study primitive people and to demonstrate that their capacities are exactly the same as ours, or a little better distributed. You don't find feeble-minded people among primitive people. They're dead. But otherwise, their capacities are equal to ours. They can do anything we can do, and they can learn in a generation things that is taken 20,000 years to develop in other places. But, and we also know that these are rather fragile ways of life that are dependent upon, usually, if they're very primitive people, they were dependent on the presence of game and the presence of certain kinds of land, very small balanced populations, and the absence of enemies of any importance. Otherwise, none of these groups could have survived. Now, when they come in contact with technologically enormously superior civilizations, which, however, these superior civilizations are unencumbered with any sort of ethics about the relationship of simpler peoples, then they had a very disastrous fate. You know, and in Canada and the United States, people went out and shot Indians for fun. And in Australia, they gave them bags of poisoned flour for their feasts. Now, under these circumstances, it was virtually impossible for the people, the Australian Aborigines or the our nomadic Indians, to defend themselves in any way. They made a lot of trouble while they could, but they were and absolutely doomed to failure in fighting our civilization in any way. And also, the minute we brought them guns and horses, their own civilization, their own old cultures were more or less doomed. That is, there is no way of preserving a primitive culture in its absolutely primitive state if you know it's there. Because if you know it's there, you come along with something or other, the measles, if nothing else. And the Tazadai have in the Philippines have been reduced to about a quarter of their population from disease, although there's being an attempt to protect them. So that there is an inevitable end to the continuation of primitive people living as they did. That is quite impossible. Because there isn't, if they can get food somewhere else, they get tired of their beautiful natural forms of hunting. You know, what Eskimo wants to lie on the ice all day waiting for a seal if he can get a nice job and get all the money he wants and go to the movies? And so that whether you're talking about the enticements of civilization or the diseases of civilization or the weapons of civilization, they inevitably destroy or turn people into just proletarian workers in a larger system, unless you've got some kind of ideology around that protects them. Now, the original ideology that protected them was Christianity. You see, the missionaries would go out and convert a group, and then they protected them once they'd converted them. And they protected them against government, and they got devoted to their converts. And so that the missions throughout the world were devices for protecting more simpler people against civilization if they just accept their beliefs. But of course, their beliefs in themselves were a change in their own civilization. The fact that there are any Indians on this continent today is due to the gradual growth of a little bit of ethics on our part. And our ethics said, well, you know, let's let them have some land. So we give them a reservation. And then we wanted it for something. So we took it away from them and moved them somewhere else. And then we wanted that, so we took that away from them and moved them somewhere else. And we limited their land. They were totally dependent on an external government they had no relationship to. Now, what we're seeing at present is the growth of very touchy consciences that are being supported by a very large number of new nations in the world. And the result is that about three Indians with a gun can hold up the United States if they want to, and can take Alcatraz, and they should have been allowed to keep it, or would have been a good thing. But the thing they are defending is not their Aboriginal culture, but is a new culture that has finally kept some remnants of the old, has been totally revamped in the light of new ideas, but where they feel distinct from the rest of the world because the rest of the world discriminates against them and treats them as a group. The day they're treated as individuals and given the same educational chances that other people and had the same socioeconomic level as other people, most of this would disappear. And so there's a continual interaction between treating them as a group, controlling them, giving them some kind of concessions, protecting them, and unfitting them for general participation in the rest of the world, and that gives them a motivation to stick to their older beliefs that give them the only sense of identity that they have. We had a Canadian from somewhere on the west coast of Canada, maybe from Vancouver, maybe he's here because I've forgotten his name, but he was a lawyer who had made a study of all the different methods that had been used by countries to deal with with Aboriginal populations. And they all failed, without exception. Reservations, not reservations, boarding schools, not boarding schools, trust funds, annuities, the whole lot had all failed. And he came to the conclusion, which he told us about in a meeting in New Guinea, that the one solution for any of these people is to give them the same standard of living as the population they live in. And unless we do, they will continue to feel aggrieved, hurt, discriminated against, and as long as they do, they will then yearn for their previous ways of life, and that we haven't, and be unhappy because they don't have them.
Dr. Mead has been most generous in this long question period. I've neglected, however, to look over this way, and there is one question, I believe, over here.
Dr. Mead, earlier on your talk, you made reference to profound changes in the next decade. Would you elaborate on those, please?
Changes in what?
Profound changes in the next decade.
Dr. Mead has made a reference in her speech to profound changes, in quotes, in the next decade, and is asked to comment further on that.
Well, you may have heard the comment that the whole of our present civilization has been based on cheap oil. Now, nobody knew it while it was happening. They said it was based on science, technology, our great technological superiority over the rest of the world, and things like that. But we've actually been going in a direction based primarily on oil in the automobile, which has been exceedingly destructive. It's been destructive at almost every level. It's destroyed, it's polluted our skies, it's destroyed our landscape. In the United States, or I don't think you have anything like that here, but in the United States we have a system by which all the tax on oil went to building more highways. And the more highways we built, the more automobiles people bought, the more gas they bought, the more tax. It was just a runaway positive feedback system in the country. And it's wrecked our cities and polluted our air and general, and whether used in agriculture or used in civilian life, it's been disastrous. And the whole style of city building, the destruction of public transport and railroads and all the things that have happened are going to be reversed. That's one thing that's going to happen. It's already started in France. Much more, the fight over nuclear energy and the extent to which some countries are certainly going to use it because they have no other recourse at present when they don't have any oil. The change in technologies. We may really decide that it might be a good idea to grow the food where you are and eat it there, which, as far as we know, is one of the great triumphs of present-day China, that they've got an idea that you might grow it and eat it instead of sending it three times around the world. So that we may change to a much more localized production of food. And that would make a tremendous amount of difference in the world. So that a lot of things are going to happen that are mainly the result of this, our sudden realization that the oil doesn't last forever and that the wrong people have it, which is very awkward. And this is going to mean new distributions of power and a considerable, as important changes certainly as World War II and the Marshall Plan or the rehabilitation of Japan after World War II made in the rest of the world. And that's the sort of thing that we're going to have. And I think we're going to have a considerable amount of disorganization before we get there. And so that this is going to be a period when change is in the wind. And as one of our previous presidents of the World Federation for Mental Health, Professor Rumke of Holland, used to talk about something he called positive disintegration.
I will also, in the tradition of the Institute, ask Dr. Ken Burridge, the head of the Anthropology and Sociology Department at UBC, to thank the speaker formally on your behalf. Dr. Burridge.
Well, Mrs. Armstrong, Dr. Lin, it has fallen to me, as the representative of the local anthropologists here, to say a few words in appreciation of one who has been the foremost in anthropology in North America for all these years. It comes a little hard to me because, you see, we're in the same family, and I have to say thank you to Margaret, to people who are...
I don't know whether you remember this, Margaret, you know. Well, most of us had arrived there, of course, a little bit beforehand, and we were taking cocktails and chatting. And suddenly the buzz of conversation ceased. All the gentlemen started putting their hands to their ties, and all the ladies smoothed their dresses. It was one of those moments when you say, well, an angel has passed overhead and is listening. Actually, of course, Margaret Mead was about to come in. Well, this presence and power and vitality Margaret Mead has brought to anthropology for 40 years, if I may say so. 40 years, 50. I was going to say half a century, but I thought that might offend you. Well, through all these years, Margaret has not been free of criticism. Her power, in fact, has fed on the criticism. The first criticism I really had of Margaret Mead was before I met her. I was being introduced to a very close colleague of hers who had been working in intimate association with her in New Guinea, one Dr. Rio Fortune. Now, I was introduced to Rio Fortune, and his first words were, "Margaret Mead is wrong." That's the way he talked. He said, "She says the Arapesh are a matrilineal people and are benign and peaceful." He said, "I've got an Arapesh arrow wound that says she's wrong." And with that, he started to unbutton his shirt. Well, Margaret, today you've tackled a wide subject, you've painted a wide canvas, but you've brought to it in everything you've said just that same vigor and vitality and force and optimism and love of life that I think we in anthropology have always known you for. And I'd like to thank you for that. I'd like to thank you on behalf of us all for coming here tonight, for talking to us, and for talking as magnificently as you did. Thank you.